Happy Friday, everyone. I hope all of you are going to have a wonderful worship and fellowship and study and prayer time with your brothers and sisters in Christ this weekend at your home congregation. If you don't have a place like that, you need to find one quick. If you are within driving distance of the Elkhart East building and you happen to be looking for a place to worship, please come on over and check us out. Maybe we will be the place that you'll even consider calling home. Let's open our Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter number 7, where I want us to start in verse number 10 in just one moment. This is a corrective letter that the Apostle Paul is sending to his church kids, that is, his spiritual children in the Lord, over at Corinth. And he is concerned that they are giving into the problems of sexual immorality that is part and parcel of the world around them. And he is answering a question that they've asked about whether or not marriage is a good idea. And Paul has to answer that on two separate levels. He has to tell them that it is biblically appropriate and right. It's part of God's original design. But he's also going to offer his very strong personal opinion that for the current time and going into a crisis time period, he advises people stay single like he is. And so when we address this chapter, we have to take in consideration the context of the day and the context of Paul offering opinion and order. And how do we apply this to our own circumstances today, where we're not in the exact same crisis, there's not all the fine detail in this passage that we would really like to see. And so the best thing I can do is follow suit with the Apostle Paul and point to the things that are clear from Scripture and give you my opinion on some of the other things. So verse number 10, Paul writes, "To the married." So this is the group of people already involved in relationships that are defined by marriage. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. So this is the rule. The wife should not separate from her husband. And then I want to skip to the end of verse 11 to keep the full context. And the husband should not divorce his wife. So that's the answer straight from the Lord. Is once you get married, with some exception that Jesus talks about as well, husbands and wives should stay committed to that relationship. Now, Paul does throw in something parenthetical there at the beginning of verse 11. He's talking about the ladies, but I think that it might also be applied to husbands. If she does separate from her husband, that is, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. All right, so marriage is supposed to be between one man, one woman, a commitment for a lifetime. Once that starts, it shouldn't end. I mean, when we do marriage ceremonies, we say, until death do us part. But things pop up, problems arise, and sometimes husbands and wives feel the need to break off intimate contact and even consider a formal divorce. And so Paul says, if you ladies have separated from your husband, whatever the reason is right now, you should stay unmarried for the moment. Don't go get married again and even entertain the possibility of being reconciled to your husband. And the husbands, same sort of thing. Now, the issue of the first century was in Jewish circles, it was typically only the husband that could initiate proceedings. And in the Jewish culture of the first century, as we know from the Gospels, even the religious Jews had a very liberal approach to divorce. A man could divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. And when Jesus says, no, that's not the way it works, it should be for infidelity only. And the apostles were taken aback by that. They were shocked that Jesus would take such a hard line. And you remember that Peter even suggested, well, if that's the way it's going to be about marriage, a man would be better off never getting married. And Jesus' perhaps tongue-in-cheek response was, not everybody can take that approach to marriage. So that's the Jewish culture of the first century, very liberal toward getting divorced, and the husband was the initiator. But in Roman society, both men and women could initiate. And it could be for pretty much any reason. And Paul is saying, you guys, you believers at Corinth, need to be working on the marriages instead of thinking about divorce. Now, we need to always keep in the back of our mind that there are good reasons for divorce. Infidelity is one of them. In my opinion, an abusive spouse would also be another reason to terminate the relationship. I'm not so sure that that can be easily reconciled. And you already heard me make this advice. If anyone is caught in an abusive relationship, they need to immediately get themselves and any at-risk children out of that house, out of that environment. They need to find somewhere safe and secure, and they should get the authorities involved as part of the protective procedure on that. But Paul really doesn't address the issue of abusiveness. He is just thinking about the culture of the time where people, as is often the case in our own modern day time period, they run up against the bumps in the road of marriage and they bail rather than work on it. And so Paul says, listen, don't be that way. Marriage is a commitment. Stick with it. Work it out. In the next verse, he zeroes in on a particular problem that would arise in mixed homes, that is, Christian married to non-Christian. Now, he will make it clear later that that really shouldn't happen by choice, that you should not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And I think that is properly applied to marriage. In fact, I advise all the time, Christian young people, Christian adults that are single, don't even go on a date with someone that is not a committed Christian. Because you might fall in love with them, develop a relationship with them, and want to get married. And Christians should never, ever, ever marry non-Christians. Ever. That should not be a problem to maintain that status. Because you just don't have the same basic moral ground foundation. But inevitably, some marriages that started out with both being non-believers, one spouse sometimes becomes a believer and the other one is still not. And so that clearly happened in the cases that Paul is talking about next. Verse 12, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, so he's making it clear, I'm giving you my opinion on this next thing, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. So in Paul's opinion, a believing spouse should hang in there with an unbelieving spouse. If at all possible, keep the marriage going. Verse 13, if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. And it's not Paul only that talks about this. Peter will later write a letter in which he tells women who are married to unbelieving husbands to stick it out, hang in there, and to not be preaching them to death. Instead, show them by your lifestyle a good faith in Jesus Christ, and perhaps you'll be able to win them without a word. So this was a problem of the early church, and it pops up every once in a while too in the modern time. Then he gives his explanation as to why he's advising people to hang in there instead of ditching an unbelieving spouse. Verse 14, for the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Now, do not mistake what he's saying here. He is not saying an unbelieving spouse is saved because they're married to a believing spouse. He's saying that they are in a special category because of that relationship. Yeah, I think it's a little bit more clear when the next phrase comes up. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. We all know that in most marriages, and that's typical back in Bible times, most marriages have children. And those children, in a time of divorce, begin having a lot of problems. They get taken to one spouse or the other, or they split up the time between the two of them, and they get two different lifestyles, depending on which parent they're with. And it can be very problematic. And so that's what Paul is addressing here, is that the moment you divorce your unbelieving spouse, you have terminated any relationship that you have with him or her and the potential of helping them become a believer. In fact, he'll get to that in a moment here. But if you got kids, the moment you follow through with a divorce, you start making things difficult for raising the kids in the Christian faith, because they're going to spend some, perhaps most, in some circumstances, maybe all of their time with the unbelieving spouse. And you don't want your kids to be in that sort of situation as a believer. So Paul's advice is, hang in there with the marriage. It'll be better for your unbelieving spouse, and it'll be better for your kids to be raised in a two-parent household where at least one of them is a believer. Verse number 15. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. Now, this is a reality that we don't really like to accept, but we have to. And that is, if you are in a marriage where the other party wants to end it, that's outside of your control. You can't stop that. You can beg and plead with them. You can offer to go to counseling. You can offer to change, whatever. But if the other person makes their mind up to terminate the marriage, their free will choice is going to happen. And Paul says, if that happens to you, believers, that's not on you. That's on them. He's already advised in the previous verse, you try to stick in there. You try to hang in there because you can make an impact by staying in the marriage. But if those guys decide they don't want to be married to you, it's over and you shouldn't feel guilty or responsible for that. Just move on. When I talk to people who are in this very situation, they get divorced by somebody that didn't want to be with them anymore. I will use this passage to say, you are now freed of that marriage. You are not responsible for the divorce. Move on with your life. Provided you didn't do anything to legitimize the divorce, like cheating on them, then you should feel free to even seek a new relationship. Because I think that that's exactly what Paul is saying. If they initiated and carried out the divorce, that's on them, not on you. Move ahead with your life. But his clear intention through this whole section is that as a Christian, you should do what you can to keep the marriage together for the benefit of the other spouse, as well as the benefit for the kids. And verse 16 really cinches that up for me. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And of course, you don't. So that's a good enough reason to hang in there with an unbelieving spouse. Next, Paul is still on the topic of marriage, but he decides it's time to explain how you should just stick in the situation you're in when you became a believer, rather than radically change it. Verse 17, only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him, and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. So that's what he tells everybody. That's what he teaches everybody. However you were when you came into the church, barring sinfulness, we're talking about just life situation, that's what you should deal with. And then he gives illustrations. Verse 18, was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? So were you a proselyte that had already been through circumcision? You know, Paul's been teaching that, you know, as Gentiles, there is no requirement for you to be circumcised. That's not salvation. So he goes ahead and addresses that issue. Guess what? You already went through that procedure? Then let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision, which, by the way, they did have procedures that they used to kind of reverse that look of circumcision in men. And he says, don't let that bother you. If you already went through and got circumcised, don't worry about it. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Well, let him not seek circumcision. So he throws this in here just because it's a current topic of interest to him. And then he makes the application, verse 19. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. That's what matters. Loving God with 100% of yourself, loving other people with 100% of yourself, and believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's what matters. It doesn't matter what your body has had done to it or not had done to it. Verse 20, each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a slave when called? There was a large percentage of the population of the Roman world, so definitely there at Corinth, that were in slavery. Now, the slavery of that time period, different, distinct from the abominable slavery that happened in early American history. Most slavery in the ancient world happened because of some form of indebtedness, either personal indebtedness, family indebtedness, city indebtedness. You know, if you were a citizen of a city that was part of a war and the war was over and the peace treaty was being negotiated, some of the people might end up as slaves as part of the reparations for the war. And so there was a lot of people that ended up in slavery, either through their own choice or through the choices of those that were in authority over them. And Paul says, were you a slave when you were called? Do not be concerned about it. So don't be worried that you're a slave. It's not going to stop you from being saved. Now, he does throw this caveat in, which I think is very important. He says, but if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. So slaves had limited rights and privileges. And Paul noted that. And he said, look, if you do get the chance to get out of your personal indebtedness and buy your freedom, or if you can be such a good servant to your master that they will award you your freedom, go for that. It's a good thing to be a freedman, a freed slave. Then verse 22, for he who is called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord. And likewise, he who is free when called is a slave to Christ. So he's effectively saying your status, free or slave, doesn't matter to your Christianity. Because if you're a slave to a human being, well, you're still a freed person that belongs to the Lord. And if you're free, you're still in your Christianity a slave to the Lord. So what matters is your relationship to the Lord. And so that's why he says, don't worry whether you're free or slave whenever you become a Christian. And then verse 23, more of the application of this. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. I think there's a double meaning here. Number one is you belong to Christ, so do what you can to make sure you don't go into debt in such a way you become a slave. Because then you'd have to, you know, do things for your slave master, some of which you might not really like. The other thing is, of course, you don't want to be a slave to sin either. I think that's kind of intimated here. So brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God. So that's the principle. When you became a believer, whatever your status was, just kind of hang in there with that, work with that. And that included whether you were married or single. So he's already told the single people, my advice to you is stay single. He's told the married people, my advice to you, God's advice to you, stay married. Verse 25. Now, concerning the betrothed. So these are the people midway between singleness and marriedness. They've made some sort of legal contract to get married. So now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. So what he's about to say, what he's about to write, is his opinion based on the principles he's already kind of talked about. I think that in view of the present crisis, and it's actually maybe even the coming up crisis, and what he probably has in mind is that this is being written in 57. We know that Rome will burn in 64, the summer of 64, and shortly after that, Christians will be used as the scapegoat. And the first Neronian persecution is going to begin at the city of Rome and in the areas around Rome on the Italian peninsula. And a whole bunch of Christians are going to get killed during that. A whole bunch of Christians are going to be abused during that. They will be the bad guys of Roman society. But even after Nero is gone, there will be on and off persecutions of Christians through the end of the first century, through the second century, into the third century. And a lot of Christians are going to die, millions of them. And sometimes it'll be really, really bad. And so Paul is trying to think ahead on what he knows at least a little bit about this upcoming persecution. He says, I think that in view of the present distress or the coming distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. So stay in your lane. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be free. So don't start dumping your spouse. Are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. Make that very crystal clear. Because marriage is an ordinance of God. And Paul is not going to talk against that. If a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. And I think that's kind of the concept I want us to close on today. It is one thing in a time of persecution for a Christian to be faced with this dilemma. Somebody comes up to you and says, I need you to deny that Jesus is the Christ, or I will kill you. I will torture you first, and then I will kill you. That's hard enough on an individual. But for a married individual to have somebody come up to them and say, you will deny Jesus as your Savior, or I will torture and kill your spouse, or I will torture and kill your little children. That makes it a whole lot harder. And so that's what Paul's dealing with here. He's saying, guys, the reason I'm advising don't get married, stay single, is because it's going to get rough. And it's going to be even rougher for those that have all these intimate relationships.